It's Thursday, June 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Hong Kong rejects Beijing-backed electoral reforms.
I think confrontation between Hong Kong and Beijing will certainly be exacerbated.
Greece faces new pressure to reach a bailout deal, and we'll have the latest music from singers Jill Scott and Janis Jackson. It's all ahead. Hong Kong lawmakers Thursday overwhelmingly rejected a controversial Beijing-backed electoral reform package that had divided the territory's opposition and pro-government forces. President of Hong Kong's legislature, Jasper Tsang, announced the results. The measure received just 8 of 70 votes. 28 voted against it. Most lawmakers walked out before the vote in protest. The legislation would have allowed residents of the special administrative region to vote for its chief executive in 2017. But the list of candidates would have to be approved by a 1,200-member committee dominated by Beijing loyalists. Democracy activists who orchestrated mass protests last year said the proposal was not fair. Emily Lau is a pro-democratic legislator.
Many of us have fought for democracy for several decades, and now we've come to a motion for universal suffrage, and we had to vote it down. So I'm deeply angry. But we have no choice, because the proposal by the Hong Kong and Beijing government does not provide for genuine choice. It is just a mechanism to legitimize Beijing's choice. So this is not democracy. How can we support it?
China, which formulated the proposal, reacted negatively to the news. Liu Kang is a spokesman for Beijing. He said the central and special administrative region governments have made a huge amount of effort in this regard. This result that in 2017 there is not to be universal suffrage for the chief executive of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region is something we did not want to see. Willie Lam is adjunct professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, while the outcome was never in doubt, he was surprised the pro-Beijing government establishment walked out.
They want to put the blame on the pro-democracy legislators because the vote now becomes very clear that Beijing's package has been watered down because of opposition from the 28 pan-democratic legislators.
Willie, will the veto lead to fresh unrest in Hong Kong?
For the time being, there will not be another round of, for example, Occupy Central or umbrella movement as what happened last winter. However, I think confrontation between Hong Kong and Beijing will certainly be exacerbated because Beijing sees the high degree of defiance demonstrated by the pro-democracy legislators as a slap on its face. That is, the expectation that Beijing will further squeeze Hong Kong, Beijing will certainly interfere more in Hong Kong affairs. For example, we have very important parliamentary elections coming up just next year. So it is expected that Beijing will use financial and other means to support pro-establishment, pro-Beijing candidates. Beijing may also start a smear campaign against pro-democracy legislators, NGOs, and student bodies.
The Chinese state-run China Daily said a failure to achieve universal suffrage will only perpetuate the political bickering, bringing further disruption to society. The social instability and political uncertainty will pollute the city's business environment, further erode its global competitiveness, a scenario that does not bode well for its long-term economic growth.
Beijing, of course, is now engaged in a high decibel psychological warfare against Hong Kong citizens. This is intimidation, for example, the threat that Beijing will withhold so-called preferential economic policies towards Hong Kong. For example, allowing Hong Kong professionals and other sectors in the service industry to open up branches in China. It is also likely that the degree of political interference from Beijing in Hong Kong's for the domestic affairs will increase despite the promise of one country, two systems. It is also understood that Beijing doesn't want the Hong Kong economy to dramatically deteriorate, because this will affect not only Hong Kong but also Guangdong, because there are many Hong Kong investors in the Pearl River Delta area and also southern China. What Beijing can do is to ensure that more pro-establishment, pro-Beijing candidates will win in elections to different layers of governments in Hong Kong. It is also possible, of course, that Beijing will threaten to do other things. For example, not giving visas and entry permits to citizens in Hong Kong, including students who are deemed to be anti-Beijing. It is also possible that Beijing will send more state security agents into Hong Kong to intimidate so-called anti-Beijing elements. That is also the possibility that Beijing will step up national security legislations, the so-called Article 23 of Hong Kong's Basic Law, which is against sedition, succession, as well as leakage of state secrets. So if that is a national security law being promulgated in the coming 1-2 years, then many Hong Kong pro-democracy groups will find it more difficult to operate in the special administrative region.
That's Willie Lam of the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Well, with a look at what's being said on the web about the Hong Kong vote, here's my colleague Susan Yaki.
Hi, everyone. The website Topsy has a story by Time that quotes legislator Fernando Chung as saying, quote, "The next move is to look at how civil society can gather our momentum again," adding, "It's a historic vote that signifies Hong Kong being able to say no to Beijing, that even as strong, as controlling, as economically, politically, militarily dominating as China is, we as a city are able to stand up and say no." That from legislator Fernando Chung and Time. Alan Wong with the New York Times is credited with calling the vote a bookend to a momentous year in Hong Kong politics. The Economist reported before the vote that, quote, "a veto would mean that the current system for choosing the chief executive would remain in place. There would be multiple candidates for the post, with the winner chosen by the same kind of pro-party committee that would vet candidates under the proposed new system." And CP24 quotes 19-year-old student Sylvia Lung as saying, quote, "This is the result that we want, so everyone is very happy." Sarah?
Thanks very much, Susan. That's Susan Yaki. The Greek Central Bank warned Wednesday that failure to reach a bailout deal with its international creditors might cause Greece to abandon the euro common currency. The bank's message came as Eurozone finance ministers meet to discuss how to get more emergency funds for Greece, which at the end of the month must make a $1.8 billion payment to the IMF. I'm joined now by VOA Europe correspondent Al Pessin in London. Al, German Chancellor Angela Merkel today called on Greece to reach a deal, but is this likely?
It's probably not likely today or tomorrow at the broader European finance ministers meeting. There's a European Union summit next week, which might be a better opportunity. But I think if there's going to be a deal, it's not going to come until the very last moment around June the 30th, and maybe even beyond, because as much as both sides are trying to force the other to look over the cliff into the abyss, that technique hasn't been successful. So maybe what they'll decide to do is jump off the cliff into the abyss and see how everybody likes that for a week or so, and then maybe look at negotiating something retroactive at that point. That's only my analysis, but just don't seem to be hearing any optimism from anybody that they're going to get an agreement this week and possibly not next week either.
Well, meanwhile, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is traveling to Russia to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is he looking for funds there?
He might be. He's also looking for a bit of political cover there. Tsipras and his party, Syriza, are leftist, and they were elected on a wave of popular discontent in Greece with the austerity that they've endured there now for 5 years without success, in the sense of now still not being able to pay their bills. So Tsipras could be looking for political help. He could be looking for some financial help. Of course, Russia has its own economic problems with the Western sanctions over Crimea and eastern Ukraine. So I'm not sure long term how much help he can really get there. But there is a little bit of concern that he could, the Greek prime minister could sort of make trouble in the European Union and even in NATO, because those are consensus organizations. So if he votes no on any number or any one of a wide range of issues, that would make it difficult for them to get business done. And Russia had been hoping that Greece would do that recently on a Ukraine issue, but they didn't. So that could be a card that he's at least threatening to play.
All right. Thanks very much. That's Al Pessin in London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A pair of new studies says that we humans are using a lot of water and are quickly draining some of the largest groundwater basins around the world. Especially concerning, the amount of water that does remain is unknown due to a lack of data. The aquifers scientists are most concerned about happen to be located in the world's driest areas, where people rely heavily on underground water. This includes the Arabian Aquifer system in the Middle East and the Indus Basin Aquifer of northwestern India and Pakistan. Factors such as climate change, along with a growing population, are expected to deepen the problem. Researchers made this determination by analyzing information gathered by NASA's Twin Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment satellites. The satellites gauge the water loss by measuring variations in Earth's gravity, which scientists say is affected by the weight of water. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear the latest about two popular singers. Today, we meet another immigrant in our new weekly series. Today, we meet Hani Wienendahl, a teacher who arrived in New York from Amsterdam in the Netherlands in the mid-1980s, looking for a new start. VOA New York correspondent Adam Phillips got to know Hani a bit, and he's in our New York bureau to talk with us about her. Hello, Adam. What can you tell us about Hani?
Hi, Sarah. I can tell you that Hani is a very interesting woman who's made quite a wonderful life for herself as a sort of professional Dutch woman. She teaches Dutch to diplomats, to American spouses of Dutch partners, and is generally just a big cheerleader both for the Netherlands and for New York City and America. It wasn't always so. In our conversation, Hani told me that for the first several months she was here, she experienced the city as an interesting place, but she was far from in love.
And then one morning in February, it was a Saturday morning, I had a day off, and it was a beautiful winter day with the, you know, the sharp light that you have here in the winter, sunny. And I was walking down on Broadway towards Columbus Circle, and I looked at the sky, and I looked at the skyline, and all of a sudden, I feel like New York came into me. It came into my heart, and I was like, this is beautiful. This is such a cool place. And I've been in love with New York ever since.
How did you survive? How did you find your own little niche here? It's a common challenge for immigrants.
When I first came here, I was a receptionist, I was a waitress, I did some office job, I cleaned apartments. But then I also thought, well, you know, maybe I can also start teaching Dutch. I'm a teacher by profession. So I put a little ad in a Dutch language newspaper, and lo and behold, I got my first student.
It just sort of took off from there?
Yeah.
Is there some way that, you know, speaking the language that way and teaching it to others keeps you sort of connected in the heart with your homeland, even though you're here?
Yeah, absolutely. On different levels, it keeps me in touch with my background and my heritage.
You still feel homesick?
Not so much. No, there are things that I really like about the Netherlands. When I'm there, it's very familiar. Obviously, I still have family there. But I'm always glad to come back here because it's New York. It's New York, you know? What are you going to do? They let you be what you want to be in New York. The whole atmosphere of New York is focused or geared towards letting people do their thing, whatever it is. And it also challenges you to do go out and find what you want to do. For me, in the Netherlands, it felt more restricted, and you were like, I was on a certain path because I was a teacher officially and a librarian. I could not imagine doing anything else in the Netherlands. Then I come here, and my first job is being a receptionist. I was really scared, but I did it anyway, because why not?
What's difficult about making it here? What would you say are the real challenges of making it in New York and sort of America altogether?
The whole social net to catch people, that's not here. You have to be able to make money, otherwise you're pretty much screwed. You have to be self-supportive here, and that can be hard sometimes, and not everybody can make it.
There's so many immigrants in New York. Do you feel like you fit in here better than people who maybe didn't have the language or maybe come from more southern cultures or Africa kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. I think I had the advantages of being a white woman from a European country. I had an education. I spoke the language already when I came here. So I think that makes it easier than somebody who looks very different and hardly speaks the language. I'm sure that's a harder experience than for me.
What would you say are the primary, most salient cultural differences between where you come from and where you find yourself?
Well, my experience with people here is they are more open to people defining or redefining themselves. And Americans, I think, do that themselves also. They move from one state to the next. They start new jobs. They do all kinds of things. And in a way, they also seem more social. It's much easier here to just strike up a conversation with a stranger on the bus or the subway than in the Netherlands, for instance. It's probably a European thing to be much more reserved and be a little more wary. Like, why is this person talking to me? Does she want something?
Is there a Dutch expression that kind of sums that up?
Doe maar gewoon, dan doe je al gek genoeg. Just act normal, because that is crazy enough.
Well, Adam, we've learned some Dutch today, just as Hanny Wienendahl learned to love the city that never sleeps. Thanks for introducing us to her.
Oh, you're so welcome, Sarah. I'll talk to you soon.
That's Adam Phillips reporting from New York City. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Two well-known female singers are back with new music and are sure to excite their fans and gain new audiences. David Byrd and Shauna Renee drop into the studio to sing their praises.
Multiple Grammy winner Jill Scott has a new album and a new tour, and Miss Jackson is set to hit the road with her new compositions. I'm David Byrd. We're talking with Shauna Renee about Jill Scott. Let's talk Jill Scott first. Philadelphia native, beautiful, soulful, rich kind of voice. Got a new album out called Woman.
Yeah, incredible artist. She right now, I think, is the face of this neo-soul movement. Even though, according to what I've read, this new album, Woman, is a departure from what we're used to hearing from Jill. She described it as classic Philly soul, which we've come to expect from her, meets country rhythm served with captivating storytelling. Again, something that we are used to, but the country rhythm I thought was a very interesting change and a shift for her. And then I also know that if the song we heard a while ago, You Don't Know, is any indication of what we might hear, there's a lot of classic blues influence in her new music as well, which is all very exciting. I can't wait.
Did you ever what it is to be heard. Did you ever feel like dirt? Did you ever give up?
Pain song.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know? yeah. You feel it. Like when, and even when you see her perform it, you know that on some level, she feels it as well. And she's been very honest about what she's gone through in her personal life, and it always comes out in her music. And I think that's part of that captivating storytelling that she's always been known for and that we'll hear more of.
And she's touring to support this album, too, which I understand some of the dates, they're already don't even bother trying to get tickets.
Oh, absolutely. It's been a while since we've seen her on a full tour, and fans of Jill Scott know that you really can't experience her fullness until you do it live. You have to see her, be there, and feel the music all around you. So, yeah, those who are lucky enough to get in early will have quite a show to enjoy.
Now, speaking of touring, I understand that Janet Jackson is going to go on tour in a couple of months. She's got a new album coming out. It's been 7 years since she put out an album?
It's been 7 years since she's put out an album. She hasn't toured since 2011. She's kind of been doing her own thing. She recently got married, and she's been living over in the Middle East, well, between there and here in the United States, and everyone was wondering whether or not she would ever come back to music, and she kept putting out little bits and pieces on social media saying, I'm coming, I've got stuff. But now we have the official announcement. There will be a new album, and there will be a full world tour to support that project coming up starting in mid to late August.
All right, that's Shauna Renee. You can hit Shauna up at @VOA_music. You can also listen for her in the Soul Lounge. You can find the link to that on our website. That's voanews.com.
Thank you very much, David Byrd. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When the magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck central Nepal on April 25th, Sita Shrestha knew what to do. She found a place near an inner wall of her house to wait out the shaking with her five-month-old daughter and told her six-year-old son, who was on a different floor, to do the same. When the shaking stopped, Sita grabbed her go-to bag, a disaster preparedness kit, and took her children to a safe open space in the courtyard. Using the tarpaulin from the go bag, she made an emergency shelter for her family. She also used disinfectant from the kit to treat her children's wounds and passed out medicines to neighbors with headaches and other minor ailments. Additional supplies from the bag, including chlorine to purify water, a headlamp, soap, and toothpaste, proved invaluable in the days following the earthquake, according to Sita, who made use of every item in her kit. Sita attributes her capable response during and after the April 25th earthquake to a preparedness course she took in 2013, conducted by United States Agency for International Development partner, the National Society for Earthquake Technology, or NSET, an organization founded in Nepal. The NSET training taught Sita how to protect herself during an earthquake and the importance of having an emergency kit in her home, which NSET provided to course participants. Sita retained the knowledge gained from NSET and shared it with her family, but she did not fully realize the value of the go-to bag until the April 25th earthquake struck. I learned about the need to store the emergency kit from the training. I knew that the go bag was important and so have kept one myself, but I had not imagined that our go bag would be that useful in this situation. The training Sita received was a component of the larger USAID-funded Nepal Earthquake Risk Management Project, through which NSET coordinated long-term disaster risk reduction planning and worked with the government of Nepal, local schools, and committees like Sita's to increase earthquake awareness and preparedness. The United States is proud to partner with the government of Nepal to help the people of Nepal.